Now
on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
Good morning. It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jeff Wolf is behind the console this morning. When you went to sleep last night, probably didn't know what was going to happen overnight. With the Congress in session to elect a Speaker of the House, the 14th vote, everybody thought it was going to come down on the 14th vote. Well, it didn't. Then they had a 15th vote. And finally, we have a Speaker of the House. Kevin McCarthy has secured the votes. He has been sworn in. The Congress, all members of Congress, have been sworn in. So you can wake up to that fabulous news this morning. So how did it all go down? Now, you've been probably paying some attention to it during the week. Fortunately, we will spare you having to have stayed up all night. We've got plenty of audio. This thing went on to wee hours of the morning, and we'll kind of take you through it because it's history and it's the first time in modern times that anything like this has happened with an incoming Speaker of the House and the number of votes and the contention going back and forth. So we'll take you through the night. And we're going to start off in the afternoon on Friday because this is kind of an assessment from the speaker designate Friday afternoon, as everybody thought he was. This is what Kevin McCarthy had to say yesterday afternoon.
We'll come back tonight. I believe at that time we'll have the votes to finish this once and for all. I think getting together and just finding the ability to how we all going to work together. It's new for us, one, being in the majority, but being in a tight majority. I think at the end of the day, we're going to be more effective, more efficient, and definitely government's going to be more accountable.
However, not everybody was on board. There had been a week of back and forth, and concessions were made to basically make the members of the Freedom Caucus and some other conservatives happy. And Chip Roy on Friday afternoon, one of those that had been holding out, he basically laid out what those concessions were.
We've put a lot of structural changes in place, a lot of thinking about what the committee should look like to reflect the entirety of the conference, specific changes with respect to rules committee, specific changes, obviously, with the motion to vacate. That allows for accountability. It allows to ensure that good bills get to the floor.
So that's what Chip Roy had to say. But Matt Gaetz on Friday afternoon, he wasn't convinced. This is what Matt Gaetz had to say, of course, the congressman from Florida.
Is this an exercise in vanity for someone who has done the math, taken the counts, and is putting this institution through something that absolutely is avoidable?
My colleague,
Garcia did not say this, but many of my other Republican colleagues have. They believe that Mr. McCarthy has earned the position of Speaker of the House because he raised $500 million to get Republicans elected.
So you can hear Gaetz getting some heat from some of the other members. Now, that's Friday afternoon. He was talking about vanity. A lot of people have said that a lot of this activity this week from Matt Gaetz was all about vanity. But that did change later on. And it changed in the wee hours. Now, the 14th vote, everybody, you know, they had adjourned. They didn't get the votes earlier in the day. They adjourned until 10 o'clock. And they came back in, and what happened was Matt Gaetz finally, kind of turned around.
Gaetz.
Present.
So that's Matt Gaetz and a present vote, and everybody's really excited. Every time there was a present vote last night, the place burst out in applause. What it all means is if they voted present, that vote was not counted toward the majority that was needed. So for each of the present votes, it wasn't a vote against McCarthy. It wasn't a vote for him, but it did reduce the number of votes that he needed. So when Gaetz, instead of nominating Jordan, or he nominated Trump on Friday, instead of Gaetz nominating all of these different people, he votes present. So that brings down the threshold number that McCarthy needs to win. So you get a sense of kind of how crazy all this was going on yesterday and last night and very early this morning. So the 14th vote, which is where everybody thought he was going to win, it turned out like this.
The total number of votes cast is 432, of which the Honorable Kevin McCarthy of the state of California has received 216. The Honorable Hakeem Jeffries of the state of New York has received 212. The Honorable Jim Jordan of the state of Ohio has received 2. The Honorable Andy Biggs of the state of Arizona has received 2.
So that's where he was striking out, because of those 4 votes for Jordan and Biggs. And that was the problem that Kevin McCarthy had on the 14th vote. So as things continued into the wee hours, we got to the 15th vote. And we're going to check in with Al BD in the WMAL Traffic Center. And then we will take you to the 15th vote for the Speaker of the House.
There is a crash. The shoulder is blocked right at 198. Now on the Beltway, outer loop, there is construction. 3 right lanes are blocked between the Clara Barton Parkway and the GW Parkway. In D.C., on Suitland Parkway eastbound, after Stanton Road, there is a vehicle fire. And on 66 in Fairfax County, westbound, there is road construction with the right lane closed right at the Fair Oaks exit, exit 57. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Our first time waking up in the 30s for quite a while. Temperatures closer to where they should be this time of year. Look for those highs to be also closer to where they should be, in the middle to upper 40s. Now, northwest winds around 10 miles per hour, so there could be some wind chills in the low 40s this afternoon. A few passing clouds and then clear skies once again tonight. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
Current temperature in the nation's capital, 37 degrees. We're at 617 on the Saturday morning update. The Saturday morning update continues as we kind of walk you through the wee hours of the morning when we finally elected a Speaker of the House. What happened when Ryan Zinke, Z is the last vote, cast his vote in the very wee hours of the morning? Here's how it went.
Zinke.
The next Speaker of the United States House of Representatives.
Okay, so that's the final vote that was so eagerly anticipated and people were waiting for. And, you know, it was in the middle of the night when all of this is coming down. So what happens is Hakeem Jeffries is the, of course, incoming minority leader. And Hakeem Jeffries made a speech, and it got kind of political at times. And we're going to bring you a little bit of it. There was a point at which he sounded kind of more like he was maybe running for president than he was just content with being the incoming minority leader. Just a little bit of how that sounded.
It was one of the most consequential Congresses in American history. President Biden gets the job done, and the D in Democrat stands for deliver. So over the next 2 years, over the next 2 years, as we begin.
So you hear everybody's kind of fussing there. That's because he'd been going on for about 14 minutes in a pretty much campaign mode. And people are getting a little tired because, we're well into the wee hours of the morning. We're coming up on 1 a.m. at this point. He stops that tone, then he kind of goes to the common ground tone. So here's the minority leader kind of setting the tone.
And want to make clear that we extend and intend to try to find common ground whenever and wherever possible on behalf of the American people.
not as Democrats, not as Republicans, not as independents, but as Americans.
So that's got a nice tone to it. But then he comes back with this. Strikes me as he's going to be running in 2024. Here's what this sounded like.
But I also want to make clear that we will never compromise our principles. House Democrats will always put American values over autocracy, benevolence over bigotry, the Constitution over the cult, democracy over demagogues, economic opportunity over extremism, freedom over fascism, governing over gaslighting, hopefulness over hatred, inclusion over isolation, justice over judicial overreach, knowledge over kangaroo courts, liberty over limitation, maturity over Mar-a-Lago, normalcy over negativity, opportunity over obstruction.
Did you hear that cheap shot? Maturity over Mar-a-Lago. And there were a couple more in there toward the end, but that's enough of that portion of the evening. So that gives you a sense of the tone on the Democrat side of the aisle. Now as we move to, finally, Speaker McCarthy, now taking the oath, and the time of the morning, it's just ridiculously late. And this is at 1:13 in the morning as Speaker McCarthy is taking the oath.
Do you solemnly swear that you will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that you will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that you take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that you will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which you're about to enter. So help you God.
Yes, I do.
Congratulations and Godspeed.
All right, so that is Speaker McCarthy taking the oath of office in the wee hours of the morning. And we've got to do the first gavel. I mean, you know, you need to hear this. This is Speaker McCarthy, the introduction and the gavel.
Responsibility to hand over the people's gavel to a son of Bakersfield, a former small business owner, a proud product of a firefighter's household. The gentleman from the great state of California, and the next speaker of the 118th Congress, Kevin McCarthy.
All right, so that is the first sound of the gavel from incoming Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy, and it was his turn to make a speech. He talked about the commitment, and we're going to get to that next. We're at 6:24. It is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. Saturday Morning Update continues as we take you through the wee hours of the morning, if you're just joining us. Kevin McCarthy was finally elected the Speaker of the House, the 15th vote it took to get him to that position, but it did happen, and he was escorted down by a number of members of Congress. They do kind of a thing like they do with the State of the Union address when the president is escorted in, so everybody goes out, and then they escort him back in. And they brought him back in, included in the entourage as they escorted the incoming speaker into the House, was James Clyburn from South Carolina. Some of the other Democrats were there as well. So it was a nice ceremony that I was watching. It one something, went on to do something. But as it all turned out, Kevin McCarthy does become the Speaker of the House, and he talked about the commitment that he and the Republican Party are making to the American people. and this is in the very, very wee hours of the morning. He took the oath. He took the oath at like 1:38 in the morning. And then the speeches started. Then, you know, it went on and on. And here is Kevin McCarthy talking about the commitment.
You know, my father always told me, it's not how you start, it's how you finish. And now we need to finish strong for the American people. You know, if a son of a fireman and a grandchild of immigrants can rise to the highest position in the most important legislative body in our country, and if my colleague, Hakeem Jeffries, with his life story, can rise to lead his party, then opportunity and democracy still thrive in America. To Leader Jeffries, there will be times we agree, and many times we will differ. I promise our debates will be passionate, but they will never be personal. That's my commitment to you. It's a commitment for an economy that's strong, where you could fill up your tank of gas and feed your family, where paychecks grow and not shrink. It's a commitment for a nation that's safe, where communities are protected, law enforcement is respected, and criminals are prosecuted.
So that is a portion of Kevin McCarthy's commitment comments in his speech incoming last night. And he had further to say on the commitment that the Republican Party and he are making to America. And here's more of what Speaker McCarthy said in his speech, having taken the oath.
The withdrawal of Afghanistan to the origins of COVID and to the weaponization of the FBI. Let me be very clear. We will use the power of the purse and the power of the subpoena to get the job done. From the committee rooms to this floor, we commit to pursue the truth passionately and embrace debate. No more one-sided inquiries. Competing ideas will be put to the test in public so that the best ideas win. But we also pledge to bring Congress to the people, because answers have not and will not always be found in Washington. That's why one of our very first hearings will be held on the southern border. No more ignoring a crisis of safety and sovereignty.
So that is Speaker McCarthy, and we removed the applause, or we'd be here at 7:30 still playing his commitment speech. So we'd kind of tighten that up a little bit for you. Abe Lincoln has made a very strong impression on Speaker McCarthy. He talked about a location in Statuary Hall where he likes to go in the evening, and he will stand where Lincoln stood and look at the clock in the Statuary Hall at the Capitol. So very much influenced by President Lincoln. And here's a little more about what he had to say about President Lincoln.
You know, Abraham Lincoln gave his life in service to this country. One of his most important observations about America applies today, as much as it did 160 years ago. He said, "We are striving to maintain the government and institutions of our fathers and to transmit them to our children and our children's children forever." My fellow Americans, that is still our mission today.
So as Speaker McCarthy finished his speech, we're coming up on 2 a.m., but the business is not completed yet. Of course, the Congress took their oaths of office. And then there was the announcement and sort of the induction, per se, of the leadership. And again, we've taken the applause out, kind of tightened this up a little bit, but just wanted to run through the names of the incoming leadership so you kind of know who the players are on the field.
Mr. Speaker, as chair of the Republican Conference, I am directed by that conference to notify the House officially that the Republican members have selected as majority leader the gentleman from Louisiana, Mr. Steve Scalise.
The chair recognizes the gentleman from California, Mr. Aguilar.
Mr. Speaker, as the chair of the Democratic Caucus, I have been directed to report to the House that the Democratic members have selected as minority leader the gentleman from New York, Mr. Hakeem Jeffries.
The Republican members have selected as majority whip the gentleman from Minnesota, Mr. Tom Emmer.
That the Democratic members have selected as minority whip the distinguished gentlewoman from Massachusetts, the Honorable Catherine Clark.
House Resolution 1. Resolve that Cheryl L. Johnson of the state of Louisiana be and is hereby chosen clerk of the House of Representatives.
So that's the leadership in the House of Representatives, and that's pretty much a summary of what you missed if you went to sleep last night around 10:30 or 11. So we do have a Speaker of the House, and we do have 434 members of the Congress. They are all coming back on Monday. Then they'll get into the rules debate on Monday. So that's a summary of what has happened overnight in the nation's capital. 6:34 on the Saturday Morning Update. It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jennifer Harper joins us. She writes Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times, and a Happy New Year to you.
Well, Happy New Year to you and to all our listeners.
Hope you had a peachy New Year's Eve.
I did.
Congress started off the new year with a bang with the delay of the confirmation of the Speaker of the House, but there is some history behind that. It's not the first time, and it's not the longest time it's taken.
Yeah, it's not going to be the last time either. Indeed, we have a very smart gentleman who actually looked at the history of these extended elections for House speakers, and that is Fred Lucas. He's chief news correspondent for the Daily Signal. That's a publication of the Heritage Foundation, very apt group there. But anyway, he says it's perhaps not unusual that the most contentious House speaker's race in history happened just 5 years before the nation was ripped apart by a bloody civil war. That's how far back he went, and he found that in December 1855, 21 members of the House of Representatives ran for Speaker. That's right, 21 members ran for Speaker, and the process to find out who the winner was took quite a while, and he said that the House continued voting for 2 months. They cast 133 ballots before settling on Representative Nathaniel Banks of Massachusetts. He was a member of both the American Party and the Free Soil Party, and Banks won 103 votes, and Representative William Aiken, a South Carolina Democrat, won 100. And he says that all this melodrama, he says the American people, they don't understand all the rules and the motion to vacate. They want to see us do their business. They know that our country is not on the right track, and that's what Republican National Committee Chairman Rona McDaniels told Fox Business News this week. She said, you look at every right track, wrong track poll right now, and people don't feel better under the Biden administration. They want to see us tackle what's happening at the border. They want to see us take care of kids who are still having major deficits coming out of the pandemic. They want us to tackle a crime that's happening under Democratic rule in Democrat cities across this country. So all the big brawls, and people are saying, you know, you still got to run the country there. But it's interesting to note, 1855, they had a more extended time here doing the same thing.
That could be one source of skepticism for people, but there are other areas of skepticism among the American public.
Yeah, we're kind of getting off of the bang on the skepticism as 2023 gets rolling. This is some interesting report from Megan Brennan. She is a research consultant with Gallup. She says Americans are greeting 2023 with great skepticism and little expectation that the economic struggles that close out 2022 will abate. Few U.S. adults also predict the partisan politics that plague the nation will ever improve. Not an unreasonable expectation, given that there will be a divided government, of course, Republicans controlling the U.S. House, and the public's prediction for international affairs are similarly pessimistic. Again, this is coming from Gallup. They have a poll about how people are feeling as we go rumbling into 2023, and here we go. 90% of U.S. adults predict that 2023 will be a year of political conflict. 85% predict it will be a troubled year with much international discord. 81% predict it will be a year when taxes will arise. 79% predict it will be a year of economic difficulty. 72% say a year of rising crime rates. 64% predict it will be a year when American power will decline. Last but not least, 56% predict it will be a year of many labor union strikes. Anyway, this is a Gallup poll, 1,800 U.S. adults conducted December 5 to 19th and released January 3rd.
Also, some skepticism about the Biden administration and the southern border. And you've got a story on that this week.
Yeah, actually, this is one of these pivotal little moments. You know, we've all watched the border follies going on down there, and a lot of the stuff that didn't happen. And you have to look at the New York Times. They've already deemed President Biden's newly revealed policies to manage illegal immigration as a sweeping crackdown. That's how the New York Times thought it.
Huh.
And others, yeah, really, others are not so impressed with this. I'm going to go over to the Center for Immigration Studies for a very terse and accurate summation here coming from Mark Krikorian. He's the executive director over there. He says the policies include minor changes to tactics, but no change to long-term strategy. This is merely political damage control, he says. The Biden administration continues to push safe, orderly, and humane processing, he says that's all in quotes, of migrants with no right to enter the United States instead of deterring them from trying to come in the first place. Again, that's coming from Mark Krikorian. And again, he says there's no change to long-term strategy here, despite all of the reports coming from the White House about the border.
Well, we're still on less than positive topics. January 6th commemorated on Friday, the second anniversary. And you've got an article about how this will impact the literary community.
Yes, well, it's already impacted the literary community. Whenever we have a big political hoopla like this, all the books start coming out. Have you noticed that? The political books arrive very quickly. And, you know, politics still makes some very popular reading these days. And some books published by commercial trade publishers featuring the text of the Select January 6th Committee Final Report have already arrived. And this is coming from Publisher Weekly. They have tracked this whole industry trend. They say the first of what will be a number of print books from commercial trade publishers featuring the text of the final report from January 6th have hit the market already. They've already sold 46,000 copies. Again, this is coming from Publishers Weekly. I don't know what they're reading in there, but anyway, let's move along. The text of the report was made available on December 22nd, and Hatchet Book Group's 12 imprint has its book all ready for sale on December 24th. That's how quickly they moved on that. The book featured analysis by reporters from the New York Times, the Macmillan imprint, Celadon, also published its print edition on December 27th. Again, moving very quickly. They were in collaboration with the New Yorker and Harper Paperbacks, no relation here. They released their book on December 29th. And again, 48,000 copies have already sold of these books. These are not so cheap. It's $18 to $20. And at the moment, the January 6th report with a foreword by MSNBC anchor Ari Melber appears to be leading the way in popularity. And it's 752 pages long. Anyway, that's your book bonanza report about January 6th. The books are already out.
Let's end it on a high note. Some sound advice for 2023.
Yeah, this is sound advice, and it's uplifting as well. This is coming from Roger L. Simon. He's a columnist over at the Epoch Times and also has been in journalism as well as script writing and novel writing for a long time. Very smart guy. But anyway, this is what he has to say to one and all. Here's how to be happy in 2023. Make saving the Republic your New Year's resolution. Forget losing 10 pounds. It's a bit frivolous now, and let's be honest, how many times have we actually done it? Something far more important has presented itself, and it demands our urgent attention for 2023. This is again coming from Roger L. Simon. He says, our republic is vanishing, if it still exists at all, and is being replaced by a technocratic surveillance state with a more than passing similarity to communist China. But we the people, have the power to defeat this. Don't look to politicians to do it for you. Many, if not most, are already bought and paid for by the same forces. If a few do something good, so much the better. But don't rely on it. Rely on yourself. The way to succeed isn't complicated if you remember that you, too, are media. You have a voice. You can and should pass information to people as much as and often as you can. You don't have to have a podcast. Person-to-person contact is often better and more effective. Most of our country doesn't realize what's happening to them. Explain it. Change will come from this. He advises be polite, patient, honest. Don't be too pushy or get on the gloom and doom thing. He says it's time for a resurgence of optimism. Pessimism is a self-fulfilling prophecy employed by the globalists to engineer a future that none of us should want. So I urge all to make saving our republic your number one New Year's resolution for 2023. Again, that's Roger L. Simon coming from his column.
And those stories coming from Jennifer Harper's column inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. Thank you very much. You can follow Jennifer on Twitter at Harper Bulletin.
My pleasure, Rick. Have a good day, everybody.
6:45 Saturday morning update. Jim Trustee next, but first, Albie Dees in the WMAL Traffic Center.
Prince George's County, outer loop of the Beltway, there is a crash. Lanes are blocked right now after Central Avenue. On the inner loop of the Beltway in Prince George's County, you shouldn't find any issues. In Montgomery County, inner loop and outer loop are at the posted speed limit. Now in Virginia, on 66 westbound Fairfax, there is road construction. Right lane is closed at the Fair Oaks exit. And on Suitland Parkway in D.C., eastbound vehicle fire reported after Stanton Road. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Our first time waking up in the 30s for quite a while. Temperatures closer to where they should be this time of year. Look for those highs to be also closer to where they should be in the middle to upper 40s. Now, northwest winds around 10 miles per hour, so there could be some wind chills in the low 40s this afternoon. A few passing clouds and then clear skies once again tonight. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
37 degrees, 6:46, Saturday morning update. It is a Saturday morning update. Thank you for being with us. I'm Rick Fowler. We are joined by Jim Trustee. He is a member of the Trump legal team. He is a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. And he is former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
Well, Jim, I know you're working with the former president. If Matt Gaetz had his way, you may have been working with the new Speaker of the House.
Yeah, it'd be nice to have him up in D.C. more often, make my life a little bit easier on this job, but I'm not holding my breath.
I understand. Anything new on the legal front that you can talk about? I know there's always stuff going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, it's that second part. Your listeners probably think I'm the laziest lawyer they've ever heard of. I'm never telling them anything. But reality is there's a ton of work going on, a lot of lawyer hours being burned between me and the rest of the folks on the team, but nothing we can talk about.
So on December 29th, there was a Southern California sheriff's deputy who was shot and killed. The suspect in the case has a rap sheet a mile long. I think it's sort of a textbook case of what's wrong between the judges and the prosecutors. Walk us through this, Jim.
Yeah, I agree with you, Rick. I think there's some kind of smaller lessons and bigger lessons to be learned from this situation. A sheriff deputy named Isaiah Cordero was killed during a traffic stop a week ago, and his murderer apparently died in a shootout very soon after that. But his mother has gotten some notoriety commenting upon her son's death, and she said while he was killed by gunfire, the actual cause of death was disdain, disrespect, disregard, a dysfunctional system that has been unfairly politicized. And what she's pointing to in large measure was that the shooter of Deputy Cordero had a long violent history going back into the 1990s. I mean, convictions for things like kidnapping, robbery, stabbing a California Highway Patrol dog. And he was convicted, and this is the part that brings out the disrespect and the dysfunctional system. He was convicted in 2021 of what would be a third strike offense under California law requiring 25 to life. But the judge, after the conviction, lowered bail, let him out, and when he didn't show up for his sentencing, released him yet again. And so, you know, these are these moments where not just a family member of the deceased, but a lot of us can look and say, what is going on with the system where a judge is actively, you know, thwarting the intention of something like a third strike law for their own, whatever, political or philosophical satisfaction. And, you know, in fairness, I have to say, Rick, bail decisions are tough, right? There's always some risk to being a judge, or at least political risk, when you make these bail decisions. You know, if you take a chance on someone, a particular defendant who you think seems to have a solid family, or they have some money or property they can put up, maybe they don't have any sort of record of failures to appear, you know, that can seem like a good risk for being out in the community with some conditions, but that can really bite you as a judge. You know, you can have your own Willie Horton story of letting someone out on bail who commits a horrible crime. And you can also be saddled with very incomplete information at the time of making that decision, you know, on the strength of the accusation, the weakness. And remember, that's all there is. You know, the person's not convicted generally. We're talking about whether or not to let them go on bail when you haven't even seen a case get proven. So I do have some basic sympathies for how difficult it is to be a judge when it comes to bail. I mean, obviously the political answer is you could just basically lock everyone up. And therefore, you never have a bad story of someone who you let out into the community. And that's obviously not a sufficient answer as well. But I think what this case shows is that sometimes judges can just get numb to violence and to risk to the community. It becomes too routine. And I don't know this judge from Adam, but you know, to have a third strike guy who is convicted of a mandatory offense and who skips his own sentencing and to be letting that person out is just disturbing. And obviously there's an activist mentality there that we see in progressive prosecutors, we see in progressive judges. But the bottom line denominator is they don't care enough about community safety.
Jim, I know the Biden administration is appointing judges all over the country. The Trump administration appointed judges all over the country. They're probably not of the same outlook on the left versus the right. How much does sort of the political sentiment of a judge enter into this, you know, how they view the law?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a very local question when you really get down to it. You know, what I've learned over the years from looking at the federal system, from looking at the state, different state systems, from getting to know the idea of being a judge for life versus a judge who may have to run for election, there's really just no great way to pick our judges. There's no guarantees that you're going to get judges that do the appropriate balancing, that make the right decisions, make the hard calls. Yeah, when you deal with becoming a local judge in a state system, the local bar associations can be incredibly political, kind of old boy systems, where, you know, the buddies that they've grown up with are the ones that are going to get the judgeships, whether they're actually equipped to do it or not. If you have an election system, then that teaches the judges go out and advertise, go out and pander to the electorate. And you can see some really strange things. You know, judges, I remember seeing judges in a state election in Nevada bragging about how they were the ones that were going to execute defendants for breaking the law. So, you know, neither seems perfect, because you've got the kind of political circuit of being in the bar association in a local jurisdiction, and you have the alternative of an election. But here's what I would say. You know, when you have a judge that does something this bad, and obviously it's no surprise that the family wants consequences. They're in that horrible position of, you know, losing a loved one and not even having a defendant to take out their kind of anguish on. But they're looking for, you know, how did this happen? And they're rightfully pointing at a judge who basically ignored reality by letting out this guy again and again to ultimately commit the crime he did. Yeah, I think you have to have some checks. I think impeachment is a phrase I didn't come to love over the national scene in the last few years, but I think impeachment for local judges, when they really have no justification, not just they made a decision that turned out to be a bad gamble, but when they do something that is borderline contrary to law, then there should be some sort of political process that kicks in at that point. Otherwise, they're immune to it, and they'll just continue to make those types of horrible mistakes. But these are really tough questions. I mean, we have these 50 workshops around the country. They all have their own system for picking judges, and none of them rises to the top as being perfect. And I don't think the federal system is perfect in that regard. So it's a tough question, but again, at the heart of things, when you talk about Sheriff Cordero's death, it was avoidable, and a judge made it all too easy to happen.
I want to turn to the latest release of documents from Twitter. And an interesting story, a Jonathan Turley opinion piece at The Hill, refers to a story where Adam Schiff had made a request for censorship. And the Twitter censorship operations people responded back and said, quote, "We don't do this." So even the Twitter people were being pushed too far by Adam Schiff. And that's just one example.
Yeah, you know, and I wonder a little bit on that one, whether that was a bit of a false flag. You know, like, hey, guys, I'm going to ask you something. Let's all pretend we don't do it. And they create a paper trail that says they don't do it. So I'm a cynic when it comes to Adam Schiff and his intentions when it comes to truth-telling and politics and social media. Well, the latest Twittergate document dump of internal documents showed something that I think on a couple of levels is really upsetting. I mean, the first is a little more superficial than the other. But what this apparently shows, according to a journalist named Matt Taibbi, is that from January of 2020 to November of 2022, there were more than 150 emails between FBI and Twitter about censoring tweets. And he is quoted as saying in one of the articles, a significant portion of the content flagged by FBI deal with election misinformation, including joke tweets from low follower accounts. And so I look at that as a starting point, Rick, and I'm thinking, this is kind of amazing. The volume of communications, that there's 150 emails between the FBI and Twitter. I mean, that says one thing. That's a pretty comfortable relationship going on there. But that they're all the way down to reaching out to say, shut down these accounts from some guy with seven followers who made a bad joke about Joe Biden's brain power. I mean, that's pretty disturbing stuff that they would even take it upon themselves as a federal law enforcement agency to establish that relationship and to use it. And they mentioned in the article that the special agent in charge of the cyber branch in San Francisco, we talked about him last week, that he identified 25 accounts in the 2020 election season and said, hey, these folks are lying about some detail of the upcoming elections. Let us know what you're going to do about their accounts. And Twitter actually confirmed to him, hey, we suspended seven of them permanently. We temporarily suspended one. We deleted tweets from nine others. And so the lesson to be learned there, it's a very small vignette, but the lesson learned is the FBI is literally enforcing Twitter's terms and conditions for them, telling them, not only here are the ones I want you to close, but tell me what you do. I want to hear back from you. And so that's, you know, again, just on a first level looking at this, pretty disturbing stuff. But I think there's a few deeper things that are of concern that I hope that the general public on both sides of the aisle kind of takes note of. The first thing is, you know, that law enforcement even in this area is a problem. And apparently, according to this journalist, DHS is doing the same thing. So you got the FBI and DHS pestering Twitter to close accounts and shut off tweets that are political in nature. And I don't think either of them has a charter that says that's what they should be doing. The second thing is the absolute comfort felt by these federal agencies and the traction that they were getting with Twitter when you're talking about something as fundamental as free speech. You know, it's not just a slippery slope argument. We're there. They are impinging on free speech, on political speech in this country. And again, Congress in my world, in my very naive world, maybe, Congress, both sides of the aisle, when they start getting into oversight, this should be mission one, get into this idea of how law enforcement got to the point of dictating to Twitter and whatever other social platforms, you know, about free speech matters. And thirdly, there was a little detail that was in this article. It's worth mentioning to your listeners. The FBI, in this conversation with Twitter, they said, hey, let us know if you need us to give you preservation requests. And what a preservation request is law enforcement saying, hey, holder of data, in this case Twitter, don't get rid of anything because we're thinking about criminal prosecution. So we're going to want these tweets. We're going to want their subscriber information, their identifying information. And to me, that's just an astounding moment. That the FBI is telling Twitter, we may prosecute these guys, so hold on to those tweets for what? You know, for bad jokes about the Biden family? For whatever their politics are, and it all seems to tilt in one direction here, the FBI is literally casually mentioning the possibility of prosecuting people for daring to say things on Twitter that the FBI doesn't approve of. So, again, I think, you know, we're in a different world when it comes to law enforcement devoting resources to the suppression of political thought, but that seems to be what these document dumps from Elon Musk are clearly showing. You look at this and you think, how in the world could these guys self-appoint themselves to become the guardians of speech. And what if the other shoe drops? You know, what if you had a totally different regime that was shutting down every liberal, every progressive thought? You know, we'd have protests on the street, I'm sure, every day and full mainstream media attention. We're not getting that, but we really are going to rue the day that we let this slide past us if we don't.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in D.C. You can follow him on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer. Jim, thank you very much as always.
All right, Rick, thanks. Have a good weekend.
7 o'clock news next. John Gizzi, Cheryl Atkison, Tony Schaefer, and K.T. McFarland on the way.